This is a HeadGum Podcast.
While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Welcome to Overdue. It's a podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
My name's Andrew.
It's been a little while since we did one of these. It's not that long, but
the way the audience experiences time, like the amount of time that passes between podcasts is always static. It's always
yes.
The same. As we record it, sometimes we record a couple right in a row, and then we go a couple weeks, and it's as though we've forgotten how to podcast. Like, to the extent that I think we've recorded this intro like five or six different times.
Yeah, we have.
Over
I was going to say,
a decade. Yeah,
it happens to us, you know, when we've been on like parental leave. But this was just a short little break where we gave ourselves an air gap. You know,
yeah, just an air gap. Keep us from getting ransomware.
Mm-hmm. don't pick up parking lot USBs, everybody.
That's not, well, no, that one's real. I'm thinking of juice jacking. So every week one of us juice jacking is not real.
Okay.
Every week one of us reads a book that we've never read before.
Yep.
We tell the other person about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. That's our thing.
That's our
you
thing.
You can't have it. You can't steal our thing. Please don't.
We do it. No one else is allowed.
No one else can do it. No one else does it better because no one else can do it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Craig, what did you read this week for Overdue, the podcast about the books you've been meaning to read?
Yeah, I read The Complete Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi.
Cool.
It is a graphic memoir that in the United States was originally published in two parts. The Persepolis 1, the story of a childhood, and Persepolis 2, the story of a return. And then a little while later, it was collected into one collection that I read.
You can buy them both separately, but you can also buy omnibus editions.
And it's, we'll talk about it structurally. It's pretty clear where the break is between the two. We did, what was it, last year we did Mouse?
Like last Mouse, year or a year and a half ago or something, yeah.
Mouse looms large in this like genre of autobiographical graphic novel thing.
They're called comics, Craig.
Well, she thinks they're called comics. Yeah,
so
she does.
She's very firm on
these are the comics.
They're called comics and not graphic novels. And from a Guardian piece, she was writing about adapting the work.
Oh yeah.
The first thing to remember is it's not a graphic novel. It's a comic. People are so afraid to say the word comic. It makes you think of a grown man with pimples, a ponytail, and a big belly. Change it to graphic novel and that disappears. No, it's all comics. Movies are all movies. So comics are all comics.
I like her. From what I've read, from what I've seen in some interviews, and from this book, I like her. You know,
yeah. She says what's on her mind.
Yeah, and you gotta respect that sometimes.
Not all the time.
Sometimes.
Most of the, yeah.
I'm
when people are
book,
saying things that we think are good,
yes,
you gotta respect it. This isn't very funny, but I was sitting down to do the research for the episode earlier, and
yeah.
I was trying to remember off the top of my dome what the book was called, and I could not. I just wrote down a quick list of, but I was determined I'm going to remember long P
word. We have a Slack that you could have logged into.
Palimpsest, which is a book that I read.
Yeah.
Palindrome, Palladium, Prima Donna, and then I finally got to Persepolis.
It only took you like six?
That's five. I got in five.
Nice work. I mean,
didn't have to look it up.
It is the original name of the capital city of the first Persian Empire, which is ancient.
Sure,
Iran.
And I mean, we all know that.
Yeah, so that's where the title comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you'd thought about, I mean, maybe that is what you thought about, and that's how you got there.
Maybe
because it's that city was a real prima donna.
No, it's just my brain was like, all right, it's long, starts with a P. We're gonna get this one.
We'll get
you
there.
And me, you and me, bud. Satrapi was a French-Iranian graphic novelist born in 1969. Yep. He's both the author and illustrator on Persepolis, which is, you know, usually, I think, when we do a comic, we've got separate writer, separate artist. I think, you know, like Watchmen is like that.
Yep.
The sort of, like, I think we did Batman, like, way back in the day, but yep. Not totally outside the norm. We read Art Spiegelman. We read Alison Bechdel. We read the Garfield Fat Cat 3-Pack number 1. Those are all books where the writer and the artist are the same person.
I would have chosen to put Calvin and Hobbes in that third
spot. Calvin and Hobbes is
maybe
in there too, but Garfield Fat Cat 3-Pack number 1. It's. I mean, if you're thinking about books that loom large for our audience,
yes,
I think Garfield Fat Cat 3-Pack number 1 is up there.
Sure, correct.
Like when I read From Hell, that was different writer, different artist. Yep, so it's, yep. You know, people do it both ways.
I think I have not personally read a more nonfiction-y autobiographical. Not to say that this is a work of complete nonfiction. She says as much in at least one interview that I saw where she's like, I cannot tell you that this is a documentary. That would be a lie.
Yeah, she talked. There was an interview that she did where like Emma Watson interviewed her for some reason.
Ooh,
for Vogue.
Sure.
And it was like, you know, this is, I can't pretend to be a historian of the history of the Iranian Revolution.
Yeah.
But I did live through it, and I can give you my perspective. And in that sense, it's kind of autobiographical. Yeah. But yeah,
I just don't know how many of those autobiographical works have like teams working on them. You know?
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah.
So that's just where it sits for me. But
do you know she's the great granddaughter of Nasser al-Din Shah Qajar, the Shah of Iran from 1848 to 1896?
Yeah, it factors actually into the beginning of the novel.
Cool. So. I just like what I like about Wikipedia is that this dude ruled a country for 50 years and she's like a medium famous author and director of films. And his Wikipedia page is longer than hers, but it's like not that much longer.
Yeah, it's not that much longer and probably has less people like editing it regularly.
Yeah, but I mean, I assume it's probably because the Shah can't give interviews to The Guardian. And so there's just like not as much to write about. But
yeah,
she was born in Iran, grew up in Tehran, yep. Attending a French language school. She was about 10 years old when the Iranian Revolution happened in 1979. She had friends and family members killed by the regime, including an uncle she was close to. Partly because her parents wanted her out, she traveled abroad in Austria in 1983. And she did move back to Iran and live there again for a while. She like earned a master's degree from Islamic Azad University. I think she got like married and divorced.
We'll
in there.
Talk about so, all of yeah. this. This is the book. So
okay, so autobiographical yes. elements. But she moved to France in her early 20s and remains there today. Persepolis, as you said, is published in two volumes in English in 2003, 2004. In the original French, it was published in four volumes, one per year from 2000 to 2003. And she, you know, she became famous for Persepolis and other comics that she had drawn, but she mostly stopped drawing in like the early mid-2000s. Taking a break mostly to direct films, including the 2007 animated adaptation of Persepolis.
Yeah.
But she did return to comics just this past month, actually, with the collection Woman, Life, Freedom, mm-hmm. which is a collaboration between many artists. She's one of them, about a young Iranian woman who was arrested and killed by the morality police for not wearing a headscarf.
Yeah, that was in 2022. If this sounds familiar, there were a lot
Mahsa Amini, I believe.
Yeah,
the name
there were a lot of
woman.
Protests, yeah. The women-led protests. And she, you know, set about trying to document it in the way that she knows how, you know.
Yeah. It's really, really interesting. Like, I was looking at the art of Persepolis, and I'd like to hear what you think about this too. But for me, who did a Google image search about
great.
It,
yeah, of course,
and looked at it for a few minutes. I mean, I was kind of struck, like, before I even read her talking about her art style, was struck by like the relatively simple lines, like the general lack of shading, by which I mean not that there isn't shadow, but that things are generally either like bold black or bright white.
Correct. Yeah.
There's not a lot of like cross-hatching to try and create
it's,
gray. Or
it's really
like that.
Jarring to watch footage of the film, even in a trailer for the film, because there is shading. There is grayscale mm-hmm. shading. And
it's still black and white, but yeah.
Like the characters are all black. Like, but you just, you'll see just kind of like stuff in the background that is just not quite done the same way that it's done in the book. And, you know, she'll be upfront about why that needed to happen. You know, it's a different medium.
But I was also struck by, like, there's something almost a little, like, exaggerated and maybe even hieroglyphic about the movements and the facial expressions of the art.
Mm-hmm.
And I, so this is from an Asia Society interview that I read. I was not really a comic reader at all. In Iran, there really isn't a culture for this sort of thing. In my childhood, it was just Tintin, but I thought always that Tintin was extremely boring. when I came to Paris, it was really by coincidence that I found a place in a studio unit with a couple of artists. I always thought the image and the text, writing and imaging, that there's no separation between them. For me, thinking with images is extremely normal. Then I discovered what comics were, and actually the fact was this is really the medium that fit me best because I love to write and I love to draw, and so really it was the best for me. From the second I made the first page, I knew this is what I should be doing. But, she says of her art style, once I started Persepolis, I was not able to make very much movement because of the fact that when I was studying in Iran, we didn't have so much of an anatomical model, and we couldn't draw so much of the human being. So I had lots of lack. I'm not sure if that's like a translation thing or a English as a second language thing, but I had lots of lack is an amazing turn of phrase.
Yeah.
After waiting 20 more years, finally, I am now able to draw a decent knee or a decent arm. But before, I thought I will take my lack and I will make a style. Actually, this style fitted very well with this story because I start as a child, so my drawing is very childish. But not because I wanted it to be childish, but because I couldn't do better. And I thank God it went well.
Yeah,
it's like the intersection of like intentional, but also working within your limitations for the art side. Like it explains a lot about why it looks the way it looks, but also it's just like, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I like that sentiment a lot.
There's also, there are some things that I think are referential to like the history of Persian art and just Arabic art styles. There's a lot of repeated, or not repeated, but kind of like arabesque, like lots of overlapping curved lines that kind of create a pattern that as you overlap it and overlap it has like a visual effect, but it's not of a literal thing. Like it is an abstract shape.
Mm-hmm.
Also, she does some, like when she's doing historical, you know, it is an autobiographical work. It is pretty limited to a character's perspective who is basically her, though, as she says, when she was working on the film, she started referring to the character not as me, but as Margie or Marjan, because she was like, that's a different person. I can't think about myself or else I'm going to like lose my mind. when she's doing some, every once in a while, she'll dip into a mode that is like depicting historical events or depicting events that Margie is hearing about, and you'll see some art of soldiers or fighters or people in crowds that does look reminiscent in the way of other Persian art, in the way of like how character, for lack of a better word, character models are repeated, you know, people's faces overlaid in a larger group and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just interesting because at a comic strip level, you don't necessarily pick that up, but it's when she decides to, because each page is laid out, not every page, but her basic format is like 9 portrait-ish panels in like, you know, piece of paper portrait in a 3x3 grid. And then she'll stretch, you know, the boxes from there as she needs to. So then she gets that, you know, sometimes you get a Sunday strip kind of like this page is laid out entirely different sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when she's in people's homes, when they're having domestic conversations, it is really centered in that, that 3x3 grid format.
Sure.
Other stuff from the research that I found that I just want to make sure we, touch on before we dive in. She said that one of the reasons that she wrote the book in the first place, aside from just like, you know, wanting a project, I think she was like bouncing between different jobs and was trying to make it with children's books. I found one article, an interview at Sotheby's auction house, because they were auctioning off like original prints of hers or something. And she said that when she moved back to Europe the second time, people just kept asking her, and at the first time, they just kept asking her questions about what it was like in Iran and having all sorts of presumptions about what people were like there that she found just frustrating to have to tell the same things over and over again, to be like, no, people are, can also be like this there. This is my family's life, and yada, yada, yada. And so she's like, well, rather than have to repeat myself, I will just make a book that I can just point people to and say, like, this is what it is. So that's where she got the, you know, impetus to make the book. And then the only other note about the movie, Andrew, that I wanted to give a shout out to, I don't know if you saw this, one of the executive producers on the film was our old friend Kathleen Kennedy, at the helm of the good ship Star Wars.
Currently doing a lot of stuff with Star Wars.
And the note I found in the New York Times was that Kathleen Kennedy was interested in purchasing the rights, and Satrapi declined to sell but welcomed her involvement.
Huh. So that's why we don't have the Persepolis
universe,
cinematic universe that, yeah, okay, great. Which then it's like 80% chase scenes. Which is all Star Wars is anymore. I think one reason she resists calling it autobiographical is because she seems like, this is from that Emma Watson interview again.
Sure.
I think she has a very specific idea of what autobiography is that I'm not here to judge whether it's right or wrong, but I do think it's pretty great.
Sure.
And so it wasn't so much a matter of autobiography, because normally an autobiography is a book that you write because you hate your family and your friends and you don't know how to say it to them. So you write a book and let them read it themselves.
She's so funny. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
On that note, nothing's going to get better than that up here. Let's take a break.
No.
And then we can talk more about this book.
Craig, what if I told you there's a thing that you could make that could do anything you wanted it to? It's just like a magical space that you could occupy.
I would
online.
This sounds great. I might have preferences on the shape of the space. What do you have to offer?
Well, I mean, that's great because this podcast is sponsored by Squarespace.
That's exactly what I wanted.
Yep. They got spaces and they're square. It's a website that helps you make websites. They give you beautiful drag and drop templates, easy to use tools, all kinds of stuff that helps you make a website without needing to know any HTML, any code, anything about websites at all. It's
that's
so
good,
easy.
Because I do not.
So easy to even Craig could do it. Our website's on Squarespace. We could probably talk about that more than we do, but we don't.
I don't know how. I know what a href is, or an ahref, but that's kind of where my knowledge stops.
Yeah, okay. Well, so, if like Craig, you don't know an ahref from an em tag, Squarespace is here for you. They've got all kinds of stuff we like, and I'm going to tell you about some of them. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. They got Squarespaces and they got blueprints. Choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Easily launch your website and get discovered fast with integrated, optimized SEO tools so you show up more often to more people and grow the way you want. Hubba hubba. Analytics. Measure your end-to-end online performance with powerful website and seller analytics. Get insights on top traffic sources, understand how your reach is growing, track sales metrics, and learn where to focus new engagement. It's all the data you need to scale your brand or business, fully integrated and clearly displayed. And also, everyone loves shopping. Sell your products and services with an online store. Whether you sell physical goods, digital content, or services, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online. If any of this sounds good to you, or if all of it sounds good to you, go to squarespace.com for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/overdue to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Again, https://www.squarespace.com/overdue. Save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace. Okay, where do you want to start? I feel like there are, with a graphic novel, we can either start with the story or we can start maybe with like the style of it or the structure of it. Because you had mentioned,
we can either start the start of the story,
which is where it starts, or you can start by telling me why it's divided up into like two volumes and what the differences between them are. Because I read that they're. Is a difference. I didn't really read a lot about what the difference is.
That's great. Let's do that. That will help, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. Because you could get a summary of this novel by reading her Wikipedia page or an interview with her without ever reading the novel, because it is pretty autobiographical, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I accidentally spoiled a bunch of stuff already.
A little bit, but that's okay. So the structure of the book. And it was interesting to read that it was split into four in the French originally. Is there's an opening book that is, and none of these are demarcated in the edition that I read. They get put into, for lack of a better word, like comic book volumes that will have like mm-hmm. titles like The Cigarette or The Socks, which kind mm-hmm. of just give you an event to hang the next 20 to 30 pages around.
Yeah, they demarcate where a story is kind of shifting
chapter,
or whatever.
You know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the bigger structural parts are not delineated. So the first quarter of the book is young Marjan living in, I guess, late 70s, early 80s Iran. The Shah, who has been put into exile, and people are excited about that. He was put there in part by Westerners, and people didn't like him.
Like he was put into power.
Yes, yes, yes. He wasn't just put there. You're right.
Yes, no, right, no, I'm just
sorry. And yes, as you mentioned, one of her great grandparents or something was the, you know, king of Persia, mm-hmm. Who the Shah's ancestors had deposed. And the book opens with everybody kind of celebrating that. And then the Islamic Revolution happens, and there is this authoritarian fundamentalist state that takes over, and instantly. A country that was westernizing, for lack of a better word, adopting more socially liberal policies that were less restrictive of all sorts of marginalized groups, all of a sudden finds itself, you know, requiring all women to wear the hijab. The book uses the word veil exclusively, I think, as a point of translation. Mm-hmm. And you can't have alcohol anymore, and you know there's all sorts of restrictions on what types of things you can buy and media you can have in your house and what you can be seen doing in the street with people, and the guardians of the revolution, they're called, are state police that just roam around arresting people for all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And she is 10 at this time, and has, you know, the world has changed around her. And before that, she's this little girl who her parents are leftists. They were part of the demonstrations against the Shah. They're giving her comic books about Karl Marx. Mm-hmm. She thinks that maybe she's going to grow up to be a prophet and talks to God in her dreams for sometimes, but he kind of looks like Karl Marx. That's kind of funny. And then, you know, she's watching the world kind of button down around her. So that's the first section. And then the second section, we start to really see the violence of the state take over. People that the family knows get into danger or are killed. Mm-hmm. Also, the Iran-Iraq war breaks out. And that is very bad.
Sure. Also, I don't think you have to like elaborate on.
No,
I think we just can generally be like, yeah, war's pretty bad.
War is pretty bad.
I'm against it.
And the specific perspective that we get is not only is, you know, an aggressive neighboring state attacking you bad, but your authoritarian government using it as a pretense to...
Pretext?
Oh, you're right. Pretext. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably worked.
Yeah, fair. As a justification for encouraging martyrdom, for further restricting, you know, social mobility and mores and things like that, leading to some, like, very significant losses for Margie and her family.
Sure.
That book ends with her parents being like, we gotta get her out of here. She's becoming a teenager. She speaks French because she's been going to this French school here.
And if she's anything like Satrapi, she's not like super, she does not want to conform.
No, she does
especially.
Not.
She wants to rebel because she's a teenager.
And they, you know, there are some protests that they attend, but they get violent. And so the parents are, you know, we don't go to protests anymore. And then members of their family, you know, lose their life. And so they're like, we got to get her out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of the second book. And that is, the second of four. So that's the end of Persepolis 1.
That's the end of Persepolis 1.
Story of a Childhood. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden for the second half, she is in Vienna. She's studying there. She is, as she puts it, she is an Iranian in the West, but a Westerner in Iran. You know, she's kind of floating without a home, and the best treatment she gets, you know, are from some other teenagers who are like, wow, you are actually from a place with war and revolution. That's cool, man. Mm-hmm. Like some kind of hippie high school punks. And she has a lot of struggles in Vienna, which we can dive into a little bit more in more detail later. But ultimately, she has a really tough time there. She has a very intense relationship that goes poorly. A guy cheats on her, and she finds herself completely adrift, as also right-wing sentiments in Austria are on the rise. Neat.
Mm-hmm.
And so she winds up going back to Tehran and living with her family again. And that's going to take us into the last quarter of the book, where she has gone back. She has now seen how even more repressive it is after the war is over, the culture that is there now. And as you mentioned earlier, though, she does, after dealing with a severe bout of depression, embark on an arts education, gets married, gets divorced, leaves again. And that's the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this dramatic irony to the book, where once you know it's a work of autobiography, you at least know the fact that she will not be there. Like, if you know if you read anything about the author of this book, like, she did not write this book in Iran.
You know, that's not where she ends up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you are aware of the relationships that she is building and losing and breaking throughout the course of the book. And you have that in the back of your head that's like, well, she's not going to be with all of these people forever. And like, what is that going to be like?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the two halves of the book. And those are the two halves within the book. I can see, I feel like, I don't know. I'm really glad I read it all in one go without trying to, like, read one, digest it, talk about it, and then read the next one.
I think, like that's how we did Mouse, even though with Mouse, there's not really, between Mouse 1 and Mouse 2, there isn't really a stylistic break. Like, it's very much a continuation of the same thing for pretty much the whole time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think people are generally going to encounter it all as one big thing,
especially if you were coming to it maybe having heard of the film, which is all of it at one go. This got on my radar maybe like not long after it came out. I knew some folks who were at like a theater conservatory that were like making, you know, pieces based on it because it had just come out, and like the professors were really jazzed about it, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And it, like, you read a mouse and you go, you're that guy, you're like, oh, it sounds like a mouse to me, you know, like guy who has only ever read mouse in the graphic memoir genre. And you're like, oh, that sounds interesting. The art, I will say, in particular, does a really, as she would, I think, has said in some interviews too, like, does really serve the first half of the book from a form following function, because it is this young girl's perspective.
Right. Childish.
Yeah.
Not childish, but like, you know, basic childlike art.
Yes. And what is driving most of the action is the characters existing in space. Not, you know, she's not doing elaborate backgrounds that are like hiding information for you. It is I guess that speaks to her as somebody who also wanted to write a novel, not just draw a novel, right?
Yeah.
It is both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the structure of it. I find myself thinking more about the second half than the first half.
Why is that? Unpack that for me.
I would love to unpack that.
How does that make you feel?
Well, it makes me feel like I might have anything to say. Because this is a big, it's not a long book, but it there's a lot going on in it. If you are thinking about, you know, how women are treated in Iran, or how she said in one interview about the film about it being a universal story of just people dealing with oppression, and because it's the same tools everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a lot. There is a lot to think about in terms of how religion over, you know, gets co-opted by politics and power, or they just reinforce each other, and then what that does to marginalized citizens, to women writ large, things like that. But why does the second half resonate for me? Because I think I had an easier time identifying with like the awkwardness of her teenage years.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, she is a young girl who has, and I have not gone abroad as a teen and, you know, tried to live my life in a different country or anything like that.
Right. Because it's so hard to decide which broad to study.
Yo, boy.
That's one of the things that's hard about it.
It is one of the things that's very hard about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it is.
I know you didn't even say study abroad, but I, like, how often do you get a chance to take a swing at that pinata? You know?
Okay, it is her going from a place where you are not supposed to, like, you know, see someone naked outside.
Not supposed to study any broads.
Yeah, and she winds up in Vienna, becomes friends with this girl from school after the friend of her mom who was supposed to house her kicks her out. She spends some time living at a boarding house run by nuns who she also remarks on their own fundamentalist religion, which is an interesting parallel.
Mm-hmm.
And then she winds up staying at this girl's house and becoming friends with her. And this girl is having sex. She's wearing makeup. She's a European lady.
Mm-hmm.
And Marjan is like, I thought I was, you know, liberal and kind of Western in the way I thought about the world. And now here I am confronting someone who is that way. And it is just shocking. Like, she just, I didn't know, you know. And so what
she's talked about that in interviews too, just like, even though she's lived in France for a long time and like been around sort of Western people, for lack of a better word, for a long time, she still doesn't like understand French culture the way that a native French person would.
It's just, sure.
Yeah.
And the flip side does happen when she goes back to Tehran. And there are women who, you know, women her age who are, you know, in their own homes. They're still going out and they would have to wear the veil and things like that. But they are dressing more American, let's say, or wearing more Western makeup or something like that. But then when Margie starts talking about like the sex that she had in Europe, and they're like, what are you talking about? How could you ever do that? You know, like they are trying to project a liberalism that they haven't lived, right? And that, that is, she encounters a version of that herself first in Vienna, which I think is really interesting. And just the other thing about her trip to Vienna is she, you know, thinks she falls in love with this guy named Marcus, and he's a tool bag. They're together for like 2 years.
It's funny how those, like, those guys transcend.
They do.
Transcend society, nationality, era. Like, they existed throughout time everywhere.
Because she had this like motley crew of outsiders that, you know, took her in. And are they all perfect? No. But they at least are like interested in her as a human being. And then she gets together with this guy named Marcus. And, you know, that takes up a lot of her time. And, you know, she's also, like, doing more drugs than she was before. And she's kind of becoming a spaceoid a little bit. She's also selling some drugs.
I'm sorry. What was that word that you said to me?
A spaceoid? That's my own. I'm editorializing.
Sure. Is that, like, kind of a slacker sort of thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know.
Spaceoid.
I think she's doing things other than weed. But there's a lot of weed. That's why I'm just kind of picking a fun, like, spacey word. Like
spaceoid. Yeah, like spaceoid.
Yeah. And so she's with Marcus, who's like one of her only support systems there. And she's getting weird vibes from him, where she's like always having to pay for things and she doesn't have a lot of money. And he keeps kind of putting off any other bigger commitments for the two of them before maybe they might go to university or whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
And then she catches him cheating on her, and it's like, oh, okay,
whoops.
So now you were grifting me and cheating on me is the thing.
Yeah.
And by this point, she's also alienated a bunch of her friends. And she winds up spending like 2 or 3 months just on the street. The only reason that she doesn't just die out there is because she gets this like really bad bout of bronchitis. Is she gets taken to a hospital and then finally like they connect her with her parents and she winds up going back to Iran.
Yeah, it was when I was reading about her background, this stage also was mentioned, just this sort of the vagrant stage.
Yeah, yeah.
If you will.
Well, and I think the takeaway that she brings back to Iran with her is this, like, there's no winning wherever you go, because if you're in Iran, you're in this, you know, it's this place that you're from and you're connected to it and people you love are there. But also you have to contend with this really oppressive regime.
Yeah.
And if you leave that place, you might find new people. They might betray you. People will let you die in the street because they're self-centered and individualist.
Yeah.
And so it's this interesting way to neither fully condemn either place, but also prevent there being any sort of, like, the grass may be a little healthier, but it's not necessarily all greener over there.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Uh-huh.
And so that transition both out of the Iran of the first half of the book and then back to Iran afterwards just really sticks with me because there's the most change going on.
Yeah.
The first half of the book is a lot more like young Margie. I don't remember as many of the like characters her age that she interacts with, because I don't think that there are as many. And it's a lot more of like, here's the politics happening to this country at the time. Here are adults that are moving in and out of her life and suffering because of that. The stuff with her uncle in the first half is the most affecting, but I don't know. That's kind of why I'm gravitating to the second half as I just like think about the book and will be thinking about the book.
Sure. Yeah. I'm just wondering, like, cause we talked about the first half being more from a child's perspective. I'm just wondering like how that comes through, how that makes it read differently, like how that makes it tonally. Yeah. Just more discussion of that, just to push you on that a little bit, because I know we'll talk more naturally about the second half.
No, sure. Yeah. Like the stuff in the first half, I'm just trying to think of like a good example. Like you get some, I mean, you need the first half to build all of the relationships with the adults that are then going to pay off in the second half, right? Like
sure.
you,
yeah.
you don't have the emotional impact of the end of the first half of the book where her parents have sent her to the airport when she's like 12 or at mm-hmm. most 14 or whatever. And her mother like faints in the airport and Marjan can see her through the window. She's like, I shouldn't look back and like wave goodbye one more time, but I do. Yeah. And I see my mom fainting and my dad trying to keep her from like hitting her head on the floor because they're both so sad about what they've done. Like, mm-hmm. you don't get the emotional payoff of that if you haven't spent a, you know, enjoyable is not the right word, but time growing to care about the Satrapi family, right?
Yeah.
And I think her parents are very likable. They're very, you know, they care for her. They want her to be educated. They want her to be strong. They support her however best that they can. Mm-hmm. There's not, you know, what you said about what she thinks autobiographies are is really actually, I think, very informed by the relationship she has with her parents.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That is very positive. And, you know, there's one note where, like, at one point when she's younger, there's an older girl living with them as, like, I think it's somebody's daughter that they took in to be their maid for a period of time. And this girl develops a relationship with a neighbor boy, and Margie's dad is like, you gotta cut this out. Like, you can't like step out of your class or whatever and like mess everything up. Mm-hmm. And Margie's this little girl who's like, what are we doing here, Dad?
Like, that sounds like a construct to me.
Yeah.
That like.
And that's yeah. also like maybe seems like out of step with the other values that I see you espouse, but she's like, mm-hmm. you know, 8 or 9, like she can't quite say that.
She can't articulate that.
But there was a quote from when she was working on the film that has stuck with me where she was like, one of the reasons she had to like separate the characters from her life was that her parents were too real to her and they were too real to the team. When her parents came to visit the production at one point, she was like, everyone was too quiet. It was like if you were working on a Disney film and like an actual giant mouse and giant duck came in for Mickey Mouse and Donald uh-huh. Duck. And you're like, oh, no, they're here. Like, you can't talk to them. So the parental relationship is really important. But Margie is like kind of learning as much about the world through other people's experiences and less through her. I mean, her experiences are of like, she develops a relationship with somebody and then that person is maybe taken away or something yeah. like that. And it's
but
not,
her perspective is just one person's perspective, as she's pointed out. Yeah. In the news. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I feel like she has a little, you know, she has the agency of a child with morals and a strong moral compass and an outspoken personality. Mm-hmm. But she has less agency in the first half of the book than she does in the second, even though it's a book about how little agency she often has, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the big emotional through line of the first half is Uncle Anoush, who was he lived abroad in the USSR and then was detained for being a communist. And then
in the USSR?
No, in Iran.
Perish the thought.
Well,
oh, okay.
And then he finally gets out and he spends some time with them, and his stories about like, you know, why he was doing what he was doing and what it was like to be a political prisoner and the life that he could have had, the woman he could have been married to, all that stuff really moves Margie and informs her morality just as much as like her mom and dad always giving her books. And whenever mm-hmm. throughout the course of the book, whenever Margie gets into like a bad spot, she always like doubles down on her own education and whatever version that takes. Like, mm-hmm. oh, I'm with a bunch of new people and I have no way to connect with them. I will read all the stuff that they're talking about. Oh, I had this severe bout of depression. I wasn't sure if I should even be alive. And I come out of it thinking I will, and I'm going to double down and get my art education or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the other, you know, this kind of moral education she gets from Anoush, and unfortunately, he is detained again and then executed by the state. And it's really tragic.
Yeah.
And horrific. And then once that's over, it's like, oh no, now we're at war with Iraq, and then like the whole rest of the book changes from there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe the other thing that is like, I don't have as much access to the historical events that are taking place in the first half of the book that I feel like I felt like as I was doing this read, I was like, I wish I knew more about this. And like,
yeah,
me not knowing about the blow by blow, like news stories of it was, I kept tripping on that or thinking I should know more and maybe had trouble getting into the book.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I got to the second half, I was more character invested and able to just like, if I didn't have reference for a news item or something, I was able to just be like, oh, I'll look that up later.
Sure. Yeah. You know? How like, how graphic is it? Just, I'm just curious because you keep talking about Mouse because you're like that Boss Baby tweet.
Yep, I am.
But for Mouse, mm-hmm. And Mouse has a lot of like pretty disturbing imagery of, you know, of mice people in concentration camps and, you know, getting killed, just like stuff happening to them. Is that sort of thing depicted here? Is it like as affecting because the art style is simpler? Like, I'm curious what the page to page experience of like reading it is, how intense it is.
It is less intense than Mouse. It did not stop it from getting a whole host of censorship here in the US because are a bunch of,
I mean, we'll censor weirdos for any or no reason.
You know, but like
even Florida had to in the last like week as we record this pass another bill to follow up its book challenging law to say if you don't actually have a kid in school, you can only challenge one book per month.
My God. Only I wasn't gonna even make my joke about how only bad books should be made. Like books that are just bad. Like they're not well made. Yeah. Ugh. So like pretty early on in the book, there is a discussion of torture that is not and a brief depiction of it that is not, I wouldn't say it's graphic, but it does like a man is being whipped, a man is being urinated on. A man is being burned with an iron.
Mm-hmm.
The last one like sticks with her, with Margie, because she's like, oh, I didn't think this thing that's in my house could be like a torture implement.
Yeah.
You do not get, I would say, to just make the Mouse comparison, like there are depictions of violence here, but they're much more abstracted or done at a scale that is not, it is not trying to show you the same type of horror.
Yeah, and I think the Mouse stuff is more like, it's heightened a little bit because you have the juxtaposition of like the mouse.
Yeah.
Like they're mouse people with like the realism of how.
Correct. Yeah.
Like bodies and things are depicted.
Yeah. So like, I'm just going to show you a page of like, I think this is after she has returned and she's being told about all of the, you know, prisoners that were rounded up or dissidents, and they were all sent to prison and most of them were executed. And you just get like, it's just a full page of people with blindfolds on who are clearly either dead or going to be shot or something.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's not much more. There's not really that much more graphic than the like ironing and whipping and stuff. And I'll show that to you real quick, Andrew. It's not that,
sure.
It's not like bloody, you know,
yeah.
It's,
yeah,
it's,
yeah, yeah.
It does have this, it's a level of cartoon violence in a way. Right.
Yeah.
Even though it's depicting
yeah.
something really horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I don't know. She gets away, not away with, but she, with her art style, she has afforded herself the opportunity to talk about horrific things, display some of them rather artfully. There's a sequence in the second half of the book where a party gets raided by police and all the men just run up to the roofs and start trying to get away by running over the roofs. And it completely inverts the color scale to be like white silhouettes on black night and then like a guy falls off a building. And it's like a full page with no dialogue, no writing or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's terrible because you're like, oh no, a guy is dead. And he's like, and it's a pretty horrific way to die, like running from the police, falling off a building. You know, it's pretty terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it is not gruesome, you know. And the towards the end of the second, at the end of the first half of the book, when missiles are falling on Tehran during the war, a neighboring house gets bombed, and a girl that Margie knew is killed, and she does see her corpse. But it is not like Mouse, and like Mouse would show you something really terrible there.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, what you are getting is Margie's grief.
Sure.
So that's kind of the difference, I think. Okay. It does, the art style does also just allow her to be sometimes irreverent, sometimes outright funny. You know, like in the beginning, there's like a celebration of the anniversary of the revolution, and all the kids kind of are not bought into any of this, right? And they decorate the room that they're having the event in with garland, except the garland is toilet paper, and the teacher's like, what are you doing? And so you have this funny little shot of like toilet paper everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There is my god, so she says, and I think this is in the novel, but I've also seen her say it in interviews, that if something is bearable, you can complain about it. If something is truly unbearable, it either kills you or you get to the point where you can laugh about it.
Sure.
And the scene that I think the scene that quote might come from is Margie is back in, I'm jumping all over the timeline, but you got to forgive
me. It's
fine. She's back in Iran. She's having a hard time readjusting. She reconnects with this guy who she knew from years before, who did serve in the war. He was conscripted into the war and he was injured. And so she doesn't know, you know, when she's going there, she has anxiety about like, am I going to be okay interacting with him? Am I going to be a cool person? Am I going to be rude? You know? Mm-hmm. And he has, you know, lost an arm and a leg, and he's using a wheelchair, and he tells her a joke that apparently a bunch of the guys from the front have been telling about a guy who gets all blown up, but then the doctors put him back together, and then he gets married, and he's about to, you know, consummate the marriage with his wife, and things aren't where they're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like horrified and runs away because it's like, you know, things just aren't where they're supposed to be in a goofy way.
Yes.
And then it ends with the guy in the story, you know, waving goodbye to her and saying, well, kiss my butt. And his butt is in his armpit. And because stuff got put back in the wrong places. And the guy that Margie went to meet is like just laughing hysterically about it. And you see a little word bubble of Margie almost saying the silhouette of the armpit under the guy's the butt in the guy's armpit.
Butt pit.
And, you know, Satrapi's just trying to like show the type of humor that folks have to get through it. And then she also has the visuals that she can play with as well.
Sure. Butt pit.
Butt pit. It's pretty funny.
Oh, no. I can't know about butt pit.
And, you know, I think at one point she brings it up to another character who also knew guys on the front. They're like, yeah, we all told that story. We all like that joke because
we all know about butt pit. Yeah.
And... you know, it's just an interesting juxtaposition where she is able to have, it's not even a, she's just able to have some kind of irreverent or charming art in a story that is, you know, often very serious or shocking. One of the things I really like, she does it a bunch, and I don't know that I've read something that does this. Mm-hmm. She will, if a character is like moving quickly or something is like catching their attention in multiple directions, she will, they will have like more than one head. Like,
oh,
to
yeah,
show
sure.
that
I,
they
I,
are.
I can see what, you are saying in my mind's eye. I think I've seen other artists employ a similar sort
it's
of thing.
Really cool. It just
do
looks
they have
fun.
Like multiple heads, but with like motion lines or something, or do you just
not
kinda
always even motion
the...
lines?
Okay.
I'm trying to find an example. But it's really just, oh, here's a version where she has two bodies because she's so excited. Her mom is going to come visit her in Vienna and she's like running to the phone and it's just like fun. It conveys the motion. It conveys the excitement. But it also can convey that like somebody is pulled in multiple directions like that.
I mean, I have trouble having one body. I don't think I would want two.
I'm going to send you an image of when she is becoming a wastoid when she's worried that she's going to...
Now, wastoid is not what you said.
Oh, I
said
spaceoid, sorry.
Spaceoid.
Well, the word she uses is vegetable because she's going to do too many drugs and become a vegetable.
Oh, because there's an eggplant.
And there's just a... It's very clearly her just as an eggplant.
Oh, yeah, there's the mole on the side of her nose,
it's
too.
Really
okay.
Silly.
That is funny.
It's very fun. And the other thing about the art, in general, because she is depicting folks who are wearing, you know, women in particular who are wearing the veil and are otherwise really clothed in such a way that you can't see them and how they move. There's a few panels that actually kind of explore her, like getting a sense of how folks' bodies are under the veil.
Yeah,
especially when she gets to art school, because there is the comedy of them being like, "Okay, you have to do figure drawing. No, they can't be nude anymore. It's a woman, and you have to learn how to draw the drapes. Yeah. Or it's a man, and you're not married to him, so you're not allowed to look at him, but you have to draw him, I guess." Mm-hmm. She's like, "What are you talking about?"
Yeah.
But the black and white art style really carries that across nicely, especially, you know, you get real good contrast between when people are in public and private spaces, because you can tell instantly when a character is not wearing the veil, and it usually means that she's putting them in lighter clothes in a dark background space, especially if it's nighttime inside, versus outdoor spaces, which are usually white background or public spaces rather.
Sure.
So that kind of two-tone color scheme serves her in just communicating mm-hmm. the cultural expectations and mm-hmm. repression.
Yeah, is it like, okay, so as we wind down, anything, any big like set pieces or anything that you didn't get to that you want to get to? Or do you just want to talk about like what about this is going to stick with you? Because I think, you know, Mouse is stuck with both of us.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I had read it before we did it for the show.
I had read it too before we did it for the show.
Okay, yeah. So you know, that obviously sticks with you because of the scale of the horror of what it's depicting, and also like the smart way that it...
Mm-hmm.
uses like cutesy animal stuff to tell a horrifying story. What about this is going to stick with you in that way, do you think?
There's like one more story beat that I want to talk about, and I think this will get to it. I think her as a person and character will probably be what sticks with me the most.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's kind of a cop out because it's the whole thing, but like Marjane Satrapi as a person, as a young woman, as a little girl who thinks she's going to be a prophet until the government kills her uncle and then she like breaks up with God. Like,
yeah,
this person is going to stick with me in all of the various like visuals that I've met her. Including a you know, YouTube interviews with MovieWeb or whatever I was watching before this podcast. But the event towards the end of the book, that is all about her personal life, that it, you know, it's informed by the political circumstances. But she meets this guy named Reza, as she's getting ready to go to art school, and they start dating, and they don't get married right away. And that she's not really interested in getting married right away. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, causes a lot of problems because they can't be in public together unless they are married. So At one point, I think her dad has to like pay the cops to ignore them. At one point, she has makeup on to go meet him for a date, and the cops might come and, you know, yell at her or maybe arrest her for wearing too much makeup. And so she actually like makes up a lie that some other dude on the street just catcalled her, and they arrest him. Mm-hmm. And she ends up telling her grandma, and her grandma like reams her out for it. It's like it's a really good beat for grandma. Big fan of grandma in this book mostly. But when they do get married, it is tied up with her dream of maybe, you know, going somewhere else in the world, and they could do it together with, you know, in with their art and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And her dad is like, great, get married. You do have to put in your marriage contract that she is allowed to divorce you, because that's a thing that you have to do given the law at the time.
Yeah.
Which stinks. But and, you know, Rez is like, okay. And privately to her mother, her dad says, the only way that she's going to learn that this relationship isn't going to work is for them to get married, because they're not allowed to actually have the relationship in an intimate way unless they are married, because then they can actually live together.
Some people have to learn by touching the hot stove. Like it's just how different learning styles work.
And well, and just like the social circumstances prevent them from being intimate enough to actually learn about each other until they are married. And he's like, she has to get married. And then they're going to get divorced.
You are not allowed to get the milk for free.
Yep. And then she,
as they say,
that is what they say. And then she will go off and be the, you know, the daughter that we know that she can be, which is a real galaxy brain take from dad, but okay.
Yeah.
And their marriage kind of stinks. Like, they're married for a few years, and it's a mix of being totally disconnected from each other, like separate bedrooms, like pretty much right away, after years of them being like, what if we got married? And like, what if we were really connected to each other?
Yeah.
And then also like arguing and just like when their relationship starts, there's like a whole page of their opposites, like their opposite personalities. And she's like, and this is why we complimented each other. And then the next section of the book is like, actually, no, that's why they never would work ever.
Yeah.
And the thing that kind of makes her move forward with the divorce, she talks to one friend of hers who's like, I think I want to get a divorce because I don't think this is working. And her friend's like, if you get a divorce, you're going to get divorce stink on you. And there's a page of leering men who are like, all could like can tell when a woman's divorced, and they're gross and it's awful.
Yeah.
And then she talks to her grandma, and her grandma's like, yeah, I've done it. I lived my life. I'm the awesome lady you know today. Like, if this is what you need to do, do it. And she does it.
Mm-hmm.
And then she leaves. She makes a plan to leave Iran, to go back to Europe and pursue a career. And she says she left in 1994. Her parents and her grandmother saw her off. Yep. And then 2 years later, her grandmother died, and she had, you know, did not get to see her in the interim. And the last line of the book is, you know, is in response to her thinking about that. And it says, freedom has a price. And just the whole run up to that is bound up in her divorce, in the relationships she's had with her grandmother over the course of the book.
Yeah.
Is just a really powerful way to end it. When the other thread in the back part of the book is like, women coming into their adulthood and like not wanting to take this anymore and finding ways to resist without, you know, losing their lives and their livelihoods. And then it ends on this intensely like personal note within her family. And it's very impressive the way that Satrapi structures it all to pull that off, let alone it being actually emotionally affecting. So that's my take, is that it's good.
Well, that's a, I mean, good take. Congratulations, we did it.
And I'll take the Iranian in the West, Westerner in Iran thing as well. Like that.
Yeah,
that's a big part of my experience of the book.
Yeah,
so.
Sure.
Yeah, that's Persepolis.
All right,
there's plenty else to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't know. We need to say this at the end of every episode, but
it's a powerful bit of visual art. I know like when it was in 2009, I think, when Ahmadinejad was reelected, two other like writers or artists got Satrapi's permission to use some of her pages, but rewrite all the text about Ahmadinejad's regime.
Yeah.
It was called Persepolis 2.0. It's still out there. You can go find it. So, you know, she is aware of the impact of her work. And as we referenced earlier, she is, you know, stepping back into that role more actively sure. with the Woman Life Freedom Movement stuff. So
Yeah.
That's it. Thanks for letting me tell you about this book, Andrew.
Okay. Thanks for telling me about it.
Happy to. If you, the listener at home, have other graphic memoirs you want us to know about.
Comics.
Well, just tell us about your favorite comic strip. Email us overduepod@gmail.com. Hit us up on social media at overduepod. We're mostly on Instagram and Blueski these days. Thanks to, I got a list here, Wendy, Rebecca, Jillian, Claire, Zoe, Grace, Mika, and more for reaching out in the past week. Thanks to Nick Larangis, who composed our theme music. Andrew, if folks want to know more about the show, where do they go?
OverduePodcast.com is our internet website. Up there, we have the list of the books that we are going to read for the month. Next week is April 29th.
Yes. Correct.
And so I cut myself because I'm reading Sharp Objects by...
You got me! I was just looking at my notes over here, and I was like, why did Andrew say ow? Oh, no.
Do you remember off the top of your head if it's Gillian or Gillian
it's
Flynn?
Gillian Flynn,
it's
I believe.
Gillian Flynn. Okay, this is going to be a Rick Reardon thing for us. Okay, we'll double check. You get your first run at pronunciation in the
outro of the previous episode.
Yeah, and then you figure it out by the next one. Yeah, Sharp Objects. Come back, listen. Patreon.com/overduepod is where you can get bonus stuff in exchange for money. Thank you very much. You get access to our Discord community. Bonus episodes early, our long read project episodes early. That's, again, Emily Wilson's translation of Homer's The Iliad.
Yep.
Patreon.com/overduepod to get all that stuff. It's a fun time in Discord. It's always a fun time in Discord.
If you're listening to this episode in the week that it drops, we will soon be recording Think and Grow Rich live on YouTube for some of our Patreon supporters.
Can't wait to figure this one out and get away from this podcasting rat race,
so
honestly.
If you want to come get rich, if you want to come grow rich with us.
If you want to come think, is it think rich and grow rich? Or is it think, comma, and grow rich?
God, we're just the tortured poets people now. Just shouldn't have an apostrophe.
No, it's not supposed to have an apostrophe. It's fine the way it is. I'm just wondering how I'm supposed to read it.
I don't know.
Mine is a reasonable question.
We'll find out.
The tortured poets thing is a question born of ignorance. So. It doesn't belong to one or more tortured poets. It's just there are just multiple tortured poets who make up this particular organization.
I believe that.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's it, right? Mm-hmm. It's got to be it. Okay, everybody, thank you so much for listening to us again for another week. And until we hit you next time, please try to be happy.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.